This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn, and I'm Lee Chui Lin. Ever since the US announced a pivot to Asia in their foreign policy priorities, Southeast Asia has been at the forefront of US-China diplomatic rivalry. Do their strategic interests align with the vision that Southeast Asian countries have for themselves? Explaining the significance of U.S.-China relations to Southeast Asia is Dr. S. Mahmoud Ali, an East Asia Program Associate at LSE Ideas, a foreign policy think tank at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Dr. Mahmoud, welcome to the show. So the first question is, modern U.S.-China relations date back to the period before the People's Republic of China's founding. What would you say is the nature of the U.S.-China relationship today?
It's very different, of course. We'll remember that when the Republic of China was established in 1912, China was very weak and fragmented. In fact, Nanjing or Beijing, depending on where the capital was at a particular time, exercised limited control over the territory of the Republic. There were warlords and generals and feudal leaders and barons controlling different patches of land, and European and American military and trading interests controlled a part of the coast. And these things moved out gradually. But the Republic of China itself found itself at war on two fronts. It had the Communist Party of China, whose Red Army was engaged in a civil war for control of the whole of the Chinese landmass on the one hand. And since the 1930s, the Japanese Imperial Army, which started from the northeast of China, from Manchuria, but traveled down to what we call the heartland of China gradually. And by the 1940s, the Japanese, the Republic of China, and the Chinese Communist Party, the three forces, were engaged in a bitter triangular warfare against each other. And the Americans tried to bring the two Chinese parties, that is the Kuomintang and the Communist Party, together so that they could face the Japanese as a group. This effort did not succeed. And the Republic of China became America's ally even after 1949, when the Republic of China and the Kuomintang were forced to flee to Taiwan. It was the Republic of China which remained China, America's ally, rather than the People's Republic established by the Communist Party, which was seen as a younger partner, a junior partner to the Soviet Union in the Cold War, which then started becoming increasingly significant in the way great power managed their relations. China was considered a threat because it sort of pursued Soviet policies in Asia. Compared to that, today's relationship is very, very different.
With that said, what strategic interests do the U.S. and China have in Southeast Asia, bringing it closer to home? What do we need to keep an eye out for?
Well, certain things have changed. Since the end of the Cold War or the Soviet Union's fission, United States assumed the position of the sole superpower, which is the systemic primate or system manager. And it sought to build and manage a global order which sort of conformed to its own interests, what it considered important and significant: democratization of politics and market liberalization of economics. This is what it pushed for. But it pushed for doing that under its own guidance and leadership and management. Not all countries accepted that. But everybody, given their own domestic weaknesses and priorities, tried to sort of manage their own independence without getting involved in a serious challenge to the United States. This changed over the last 15, 20 years, particularly with China. In 1993, the Chinese Communist Party, there are two organs. One is the Central Committee and the other is the Central Military Commission, organized a conference at which a 30-day period review was done, a preview of China's national interests. And the analysts and the political leaders attending that conference came to a consensus that The United States, Japan, and South Korea triangular alliance pose the gravest threat to China's independence and national security over the next 30 years, and that China must build what they called its comprehensive national power to defend its own interests. And in 1999, 6 years after this, the United States Department of Defense conducted its own study and identified China as the most likely challenger of the U.S.-led order. And in that period, 1999-2000, the United States executive branch, that is the government, and the legislative branch, that is the Congress, came together in identifying China as a potential threat to America's primacy. And then specific policies were taken by the United States and in response by China vis-a-vis each other. And that then created a degree of polarization in terms of politics and strategy between the United States and China, as each saw the other as a potential threat. But on the economic and financial side, the relationship was just the reverse, and we can talk about that later.
And how did that affect how each of those sides viewed Southeast Asia as, you know, a potential ally or a potential avenue for investments, for partnerships?
Southeast Asia has a very interesting history, if you like. ASEAN was set up in 1967 at a time when you may remember that the Indochina War was raging, but the U.S.-led Southeast Asia Treaty Organization was moribund. It did not actually prove very effective. So the regional five major powers decided to get together to pursue primarily economic, but also diplomatic, and to a much lesser extent, their strategic interest as a collective body. And this group operated on the basis of consensus. And that meant that decisions are slow, arguments a lot, and Western perception of ASEAN was not very positive. After the end of the Indochina War and America's withdrawal, three mainland countries also joined ASEAN, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and subsequently Myanmar as well. So Southeast Asia became a whole. It became a collective of the entire Southeast Asian geographical region. So therefore, it became a proper player in the global geopolitical game. But nonetheless, because of its very diverse political economic circumstances among the members, there were differences in perceptions, in interests, in priorities, and therefore there was not that much cohesion. And when China and the United States became geopolitical competitors, then some ASEAN members found themselves sort of driven to take sides. So therefore, you see that the Philippines and Thailand are allies, formal allies of the United States, Cambodia, Laos, and until recently, Myanmar, were much more closely aligned to China and the other countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, and increasingly Vietnam, see themselves shifting towards the United States. But nonetheless, this is still very fluid. If you look at very recent development, policy developments in the Philippines and the recent visit by Malaysia's prime minister to China, you can see that within ASEAN, there are nuances and gradations of policy preferences. Some are moving closer to the United States, others are moving closer to China, and some are focusing on the economic interests, others are focusing on security interests. So there is a great deal of fluidity within ASEAN itself as China and the United States pursue their respective interests here.
And in the midst of this, you are saying that we live in a time similar to the late 80s. Could you elaborate on that? I mean, that's 30 years ago now.
Yes.
What do you see mirroring one another?
Well, until the late 1980s, the Soviet Union and the United States occupied what strategists would call the core of the international security system. So those two powers in their bipolar dark relationship dominated all global security policies, and the rest of the world felt sort of forced to either align themselves in their own security interests, either to the United States or to the Soviet Union. And China, since the early 1970s, found itself gradually moving towards the United States, tacitly allying itself to U.S. strategic policy. While the United States and the Soviet Union were considered the two superpowers at the core of the international security system, China was the great unknown until early 1970s when, because it also shared perceived threats from the Soviet Union, gradually moved towards the United States in a tacit alliance. And China and the United States collaborated very closely in proxy warfare across Latin America, Central America, Southern Africa, the Horn of Africa, Afghanistan, and in Indochina. That alliance provided about 18 years of very close collaboration between the United States and China. Then the Soviet Union collapsed and things changed. And we're at a stage when the system, the international security system, is facing a transition to something new and different. We do not know what the end state of this transition will be. We do know things are changing. Until now, for the last two decades, a quarter century, the United States was the sole superpower with no overt challenge to its dominance or authority. Now, Russia in Europe and China in Asia are questioning America's preeminence. They're asserting what they consider their own rights, and they're trying to persuade their neighboring countries, smaller countries, to join them in a completely different coalition. And this is not just military or geostrategic. It's also geoeconomic. If you look at China's AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Bank, and you see its BRI, the Belt Road Initiative, and you see the way the BRICS grouping of five countries, including China, Russia, India, South Africa, and Brazil, have built their own international investment bank, the New Development Bank. You see a whole host of organizations developing that question the unique nature of the institutions set up after the Second World War, which reflected primarily United States interests. And so, both in terms of geoeconomics and geopolitics, a new era is dawning. Transitions bring uncertainty because we don't know what will happen 5-10 years from now. And uncertainty causes grave anxiety among governments and elites. If they try to hedge and balance and try to protect their own country's interests. And that's why there's a degree of uncertainty and fluidity in movements. That's why the new president of the Philippines is making statements that really challenge all assumptions we have had over U.S.-Filipino relations for the past 60 years. And similarly, other countries as well. And that's what I mean by the similarity between now and what we saw in the late 1980s.
You also have called this the Asia-Pacific century in one of your books. Why is that?
Well, since the 15th century, when European navigators and commercial leaders began traversing the planet to look for new worlds, new trading markets, new sources of resources, and new countries to colonize, for 500 years, the Euro-Atlantic zone, mostly Western European countries, but for the last 100 years, United States. So Euro-Atlantic Caucasoid zone dominated the politics, the economics, science and technology, military and diplomacy around the world. The world order was dominated by a dominant system centered across the Atlantic Ocean. It was a Euro-Atlantic world. Most aspects of human endeavor, from art to science, from medicine to geometry, everything came from or was refined by the Euro-Atlantic center of the planetary order. That's shifted over the last 20 years. First with Japan, then with South Korea, Taiwan, Southeast Asia, and now China. With these Western Pacific or Eastern European revival of economic power and national confidence, the Asia-Pacific is becoming increasingly the center of gravity of global commerce and economics. And commerce and economics provide the foundation for politics. And that's why I call this the Asia-Pacific century.
My guest today is Dr. Mahmoud Ali, an East Asia Program Associate at LSE Ideas. Up next, we continue our conversation about U.S.-China relations and how that affects Southeast Asia. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. My guest today, Dr. Mahmoud Ali, East Asia Program Associate at LSE Ideas. We're talking about U.S.-China relations and how that impacts us here in Southeast Asia. Now, I'm going to preface the next question by saying that considering that Southeast Asia has many countries, each with its own agenda, it might not be possible to have a simple answer. But what role does Southeast Asia or do Southeast Asian states want the U.S. and China to play in the region?
Well, a very interesting question because ASEAN, as you know, at the end of 2015, proclaimed a community with three different aspects. There was economic, sociocultural, and political security. And we're talking about the political security aspect. This is the most crucial one because they deal with nations' existence and their well-being, their survival, and their future. And in this respect, ASEAN countries remain deeply divided. These divisions would not matter if the United States and China worked together and cooperatively without competing with each other. And throughout the 1970s and the 1980s, the United States and China actually did cooperate. If you look at Indochina, the United States and China cooperated over Cambodia against Vietnam. That is not the case anymore. Because that is not the case anymore, and both are major powers, both have major interests and major capabilities with which to pursue their interests, Southeast Asian countries are in a way torn in making choices. They have until now made one particular set of choices in that, in terms of economic growth and commercial relationship, all of them have very close ties to China. China's economy has grown at a dramatic rate over the last 30, 35 years. And these countries have aligned with the Chinese economy so that China, when it became the factory of the world, Southeast Asian countries and indeed other East Asian countries became part of that global supply chain. Everybody provided components which were then transported to China and assembled there. Value addition was done in all of these countries, and the final product was then exported to the West, to the United States, Canada, and the European Union, and elsewhere, as well as for regional consumption. So the economic processes caused an integration between China on the one hand and Southeast Asian countries on the other. In terms of security, as China grew and started asserting its long-held principles and policies and proclamations, Southeast Asian countries, many of them, or most of them, got quite nervous and increasingly developed intensive security relationship with the United States. So there is this dichotomy in that close commercial economic relationship with China and close security ties to the United States. This did not matter if the United States and China did not compete. And in economic terms, China and the United States are very closely integrated, investment, production, manufacturing, and so on. But in strategic terms, they are competitors. And this competition is because the United States wishes to perpetuate its systemic primacy or dominance. And China seeks to expand its strategic autonomy, its envelope within which it can pursue its own interest beyond the first and the second island chain. And that is something the United States seeks to prevent from happening. And America's allies within ASEAN and with Japan and indeed other countries are seeking to stop China's outward expansion. This is why it's becoming increasingly difficult and challenging.
With these conflicting interests at play, is ASEAN itself as an organization, a coalition, an adequate counterbalance to US and Chinese interests within our region?
ASEAN has sought to pursue what it calls ASEAN centrality, that in the evolution and the development or fashioning of the East Asian security architecture in the 21st century, ASEAN will play the pivotal role. It will determine how other countries interact with each other. It has tried to do this, and the United States endorsed the centrality of ASEAN in repeated conferences and official statements. It has done so. And very recently, the Chinese leadership has also done so. So there is that convergence. And indeed, since neither the United States nor the Chinese government would wish to engage in a war, which would be catastrophic for everybody, there is a fundamental interest in finding paths to negotiated resolution of disputes. And I think very slowly, very gradually, with pitfalls inevitable, we are seeing movement in the direction. And ASEAN could actually help to bring these two parties together, the United States and China. But to do that, it's fundamental that ASEAN itself evolve into a more coherent spokesperson for the region. And that is a major challenge. Efforts must be made, and since now we have an ASEAN community, therefore the formal structure is there. The question is, can the leadership from these 10 member countries bring themselves together to speak with a single voice? If they can do that, then the answer is yes.
And that is so difficult, partly because different cultures, different backgrounds, but also different interests, different relationships. And we're seeing that, as you mentioned, with President Duterte's recent statements with regard to the United States changing very rapidly the old relationship that the two countries used to share. So what are your thoughts then on President Duterte's alignment with China and with Russia?
I would be very surprised, to be honest, if what the president says is exactly what the government of the Philippines will do over the next 3 or 4 years. Politicians in most countries, if you look at the current election campaign rhetoric in the United States, for example, politicians campaigning do make a lot of statements. Some of them are slightly more colorful and exciting and energetic. Whether in real-term policy shifts are that dramatic, it's difficult to say. And I'll give you a couple of examples from the Philippines' recent past. The Philippines were given independence in 1946 by the United States, which colonized it from 1898, the Spanish-American War. Filipino and American forces fought together as guerrillas in the Philippines against Japanese occupation forces. After America granted independence to the Philippines, there were many positives and many negatives, as is the case in most relationship. America actually ensured that the Philippines grew economically, became a proper society, despite its sort of very diverse and disparate archipelagic geography. And provided a lot of economic support, provided for its security, really made the modern Philippines what it is today. But a lot of Filipinos, nationalistic in their outlook, saw the Americans as sort of colonizers and racist. And the phrase, Howard Taft's infamous phrase of little brown brothers, rankles with many Filipinos even today, as you know. So nationalist Filipinos seek independence, autonomy, the ability to sort of shape and guide their own future and not remain overtly dependent on external powers, particularly former colonial masters. So what the current Filipino government is doing, perhaps the language is a bit extreme, is expanding its capacity to engage with other major powers and expand its, if you like, toolbox of diplomatic leverage, rather than completely cut off its very well-established and long-established alliance relationship with the United States. Philippines will not become an ally of China. I'm sort of convinced. However, it wishes not to engage in China as an adversary or as a client of the United States in a Sino-US competition. It wishes to expand its own space of diplomacy and managing relationship.
And as part of that, we've seen China allowing Filipino fishermen to work around the contested fishing ground around Scarborough Shoal. Is this, in your view, a sustainable workaround the South China Sea territorial dispute, which has been going on now for what feels like an age?
I think the Chinese have really gone back to their original demand. The dispute's been negotiated by the parties themselves rather than by external powers or actors. And the Philippines have now agreed with the Chinese to revive the pre-2012 negotiating mechanisms. And it is possible that negotiations bilaterally but also multilaterally on a code of conduct, which has been in the works for many years now, will gradually become slightly more energetic. But since so many different parties are involved, different interests involved, and sort of contradictory and conflicting interests involved, negotiations will take place. And given the record that China has negotiated its land boundaries with about 12 neighboring countries over many years, but has done so, including Vietnam, it is reasonable to assume some sort of a negotiated resolution would be feasible for the South China Sea as well. It requires engagement rather than hostile activities. And that's the point China has been making, and I think the current Filipino government agrees with that.
We've been talking about China and the United States while ignoring Russia, who is also seeking to widen its regional influence. What do you make of this?
Russia is very interesting as well. If you see the Russian royal insignia, it's a double-headed eagle. One head points to the west, one head points to the east. And Tsarist Russia in the 19th century forced the Qing dynasty in China to cede very large tracts of territory in the Amur Basin. And there is a concern among the Russian elite that a strong China and densely populated China will seek to reacquire some of that lost territory. Of course, the Chinese government has sort of finalized the border agreement with Russia and shows no sign of that. But remember, Asiatic Russia is sparsely populated as a large land territory with a lot of resources. China has a very dense population, requires a lot of resources. Russia has it. So there is that tension. Russia has something China needs and wants, and Russia is worried about losing it. Russia also wishes to revive Russia's traditional position as a major global power. And Asia, or Asia-Pacific, provides a theater in which revival is becoming increasingly important. And I think over the next 5 or 6 years, we will see increasing Russian activism in the Asia-Pacific region, perhaps in concert with China, sort of countervailing American activism in this region, but perhaps independently vis-a-vis Japan.
I'm speaking today with Dr. S. Mahmoud Ali, an East Asia Program Associate at LSE Ideas, which is a foreign policy think tank at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Up next, we continue our conversation about U.S.-China relations and how that impacts us here in Southeast Asia by addressing the grievances that both Malaysia as well as our neighboring countries like the Philippines have had. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, VFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are still listening to Live and Learn with me, Lee Chui Lin. And my guest today is Dr. Mahmoud Ali, East Asia Program Associate at LSE Ideas, a foreign policy think tank at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We're talking today about U.S.-China relations and Southeast Asia. We've also seen that the Philippines, as well as Malaysia here, both have grievances on how the US has directly interfered and spoken out on both countries' domestic affairs. Is this a sign of things to come with the US kind of asserting that level of dominance and countries in some ways pushing back?
I think there is always, if you look at history, there is always a cycle to it. I'm currently writing a book on history of this region. And I go back to the 1940s and 50s. Even very weak client states like Japan or South Korea, which were in the 1940s and 50s utterly dependent on United States protection and economic and industrial and financial support, were pushing back wherever their fundamental economic interest or security interest are concerned. And they felt that U.S. demands were exorbitant, were intolerable, and were questionable or not legitimate. They pushed back. And it is always the case that however weak a client state is, when its elites determine that their fundamental interests are being challenged by the patron power, they will push back. It's happened historically throughout the 40s and 50s. And I'm sure that this will continue to be the case as we go ahead.
But is the issue of human rights straining the U.S. relations with some countries in Southeast Asia? Because that seems to be the platform upon which pronouncements or statements are made from the United States.
Human rights have been a particular contentious issue between the United States and many Asian countries, and indeed many countries around the world. Every year, the United States Department of State publishes a record of human rights violations by many different countries. And each year, these publications cause a lot of grief among countries in Asia and indeed elsewhere. Recently, the government of China has started publishing such an annual book on human rights in the United States. Each society evolves in its own fashion. There are many different forces and tendencies that shape the trajectory societies take. And I have heard China's leaders, in response to questions asked by others, observers, external, including myself, respond this way, that every society must find its own way to its future. You can try to impose values by parachuting them in, but you cannot grow roots domestically. For sustained, stable political changes, those changes must grow indigenously within the local culture. And that's why human rights are a major source of contention between the United States on the one hand and other countries on the other. Particularly some have pointed out that there are gross abuse of human rights within the United States itself. So I suspect this will be something, a debate that we will hear more and more in future as well.
So with all that said, to what extent should the U.S. continue to exert leadership in Southeast Asia, or does it need to take on a different form of leadership? I mean, we've been talking about that conflict between perhaps economic interests and economic interests and security interests, for example. Does the United States itself need to pivot?
I think the elections on the 8th of November will really present the American voters with two somewhat different choices. From what we have heard from Mr. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, suggests that the Trump presidency, if it comes to pass, will be somewhat more domestically focused and less exuberant in terms of global dominion. Policies will shift. The Hillary Clinton presidency, if it comes to pass, will demonstrate greater degree of continuity with America's preeminence finding a major role in shaping America's foreign policy. So the American people are generally focused on domestic issues in their elections. It's difficult to say until we know who becomes the president on the 20th of January. But the two candidates do provide quite different perspectives on the world and on America's role in the world. On the whole, I believe, given its history since the Second World War, the United States will have institutional and corporate dynamics, propelling it towards maintaining its systemic leadership. But that leadership will be very expensive if it is sustained in the current fashion, where the military plays the dominant role, and it will face many challenges. If, on the other hand, a more collegial, collaborative approach is taken, where other powers are invited as partners to share roles and responsibilities and costs, then U.S. leadership will become more effective and much more sustainable.
Are there opportunities for the U.S. and China to collaborate economically in the region, and to what extent might we see that?
I think there are great opportunities. For one thing, for the last 10 years, but more generally, since the United States assisted China to become a member of the World Trade Organization at the turn of the century, U.S.-Chinese economic relationship has been so deeply intertwined that some Western economists have described this as symbiotic. They're so mutually dependent and integrated that there is great mutual interest in continuing that relationship. And if they do that, then as a major source of resources and as a major market for their goods and services, Southeast Asia will remain a central player that can leverage its collective weight as a massive and growing market and as a sort of increasingly important producer of goods and services to influence policies and perceptions in both Beijing and Washington. To that extent, I think the economic integration between the United States and China on the one hand and Southeast Asia on the other really provides a promising opportunity for all parties in this particular dynamic.
And can we also see assistance from U.S. and China to Southeast Asia in terms of cybersecurity and counterterrorism? Because those are also increasing concerns.
This is one area where we have seen since 2001, the United States and China have collaborated in counterterrorism activities. They have shared intelligence. And in the 1980s, they worked very closely together in Afghanistan. So there is a lot of history in terms of collaboration in counterterrorism. And that, to a lesser extent, goes on. Cybersecurity has been a major bone of contention between China and the United States. But since President Xi Jinping's visit to the United States last year, we have seen China increasingly acceding to the American framework of what cybersecurity entails, what the behavioral pattern that would be acceptable, and what the penalties would be in case those norms are broken. It is a fact. It's a recognized and known fact that both China and the United States conduct widespread cyber espionage. But so does most other countries. China and the United States are not unique. What's different is that China and the United States are so far ahead of the game of anybody else that they can pretty much secure any kind of data that they wish from the other party and have done so. The Americans have pointed out that any commercial information or sort of IPR-related information is not subjected to espionage. China had until last year rejected that particular contention, but now China also agrees that IPR must be honored. So to that extent, as China rises up the value chain, produces more high technology goods and products, it would also share America's interest in protecting IPR in the cyber realm. So there is a great deal of convergence. And if that convergence is leveraged by United States and China, but also by Southeast Asia, then we will see a great opportunity for working together. In fact, last year, the G20 produced a framework for cybersecurity for all G20 members based on the agreement between the United States and China. So there is a great deal of potential there.
And finally, in closing, with these two countries kind of having so many different interests, having so many different activities, quote-unquote, how should a country like Malaysia position itself?
I think Malaysia has positioned itself so far quite intelligently, cleverly. Until now, Malaysia had pushed, if you like, low-profile security ties with the United States, like some of its neighbors, and very strong and elaborate economic commercial relationship with China. But increasingly, as Sino-US competition has intensified, Malaysia has taken the decision that while disputes exist, there are peaceful and diplomatic ways of addressing those disputes rather than engaging in violence or coercion or threats or challenges. And very recently, Malaysia has also agreed to procure naval platforms and technology from China, which suggests that Malaysia is now also expanding its strategic autonomy by not just remaining tied to the United States in security terms, but also expanding its security ties to China, which means when you have two players with whom to play, your own autonomy expands. But while this is good during peacetime, should there ever be an unlikely conflict between the United States and China, then countries like Malaysia may be forced to take sides. And that is a dangerous thing to do.
Thank you very much for coming in today. I've been speaking with Dr. Mahmud Ali, East Asia Program Associate over at LSE Ideas, a foreign policy think tank at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We've been talking about US-China relations and how that impacts us here in Southeast Asia. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.